All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuckadelics, what the fuck Tuckians? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I'm in a large hotel room, not a fancy hotel room. I guess it's fancy for a hotel that one goes to on the road. It is a Holiday Inn Express. They are not paying for that plug. I'm just trying to give those people that do the traveling a sense of where I'm at. So it's a large room with a big bed, and there's a little kitchen operation here with a microwave and a fridge and an ugly sink. There's a couple of chairs over there, and I don't know what's gone on over there. We've discussed that, but if I sit here and I'm left to my own devices and I picture the possibilities of what could happen in two sort of lounge chairs in a hotel suite outside of Rochester, New York, sky's the limit. Anywhere from a nice business meeting to a three-day crank bender and all that entails. Today on the show, we have Ron Perlman. You might know him from the Anarchy Show, that thing. And, you might have seen Ron on my show. That was fun. It was great working with him. Or you might have been watching his original Amazon series, Hand of God. Season one's up and season two's coming. He also has a book out, Sons of Anarchy. Sorry. I don't do that on purpose. I'm old manning. I'm starting to old man a bit. You know, the thing with the thing, it's my father who's in town, by the way. He's right down the hall in Rochester. What is that about? Good question. Maybe you're asking, why isn't he on the show? Why aren't you talking to him right now? I don't know that that would be great for everybody. I don't know that he's really a on-the-mic personality. I don't know if that's necessary, but I will tell you this. He's down the hall, and I can feel the vortex from here. He's literally five rooms down in a similar room. I know what's going on in the chair in that room. Probably a bit of sad reflection. But anyways, getting back to Ron Perlman. He's got a book out called Easy Street, The Hard Way. That's out in paperback. So I'll talk to Ron in a little bit, but let me get you up to speed with what's happening with me, if that's okay. Those of you who are checking out, good riddance. Good riddance to you, but I've got things to talk about, and you're missing out. The tour. I'm doing two shows at the Wilbur Theater in Boston, Massachusetts, September 24th. And then I will be at Campbell Hall at UCSB in Santa Barbara, October 21st. I'm doing a big show at Largo, October 22nd. And I'm doing a club show at the Ice House, October 23rd. And of course, there are a few tickets left for Carnegie Hall, November 4th in New York City. And I mean that there are a few tickets left. I would get those tickets. They are going. It is happening. So that's that update. In terms of what's going on with me personally, I've not started shooting the new show on Netflix. I've not started shooting Glow. I am now in Rochester, New York. I was talking about before last Thursday, my significant other, my partner, my lady friend, someone came up with a good one. How about my lover, my lover's show, Sarah Kane's art show at Gallery LaLong. In New York City went beautifully. It was a great event, man. Thursday night, real art opening, Chelsea style in New York. There's a lot of other openings on the street. A lot of people came out. I want to thank the fans who came out, fans of mine who had never met me or seen art or that art. A lot of my fans are creatives, and I don't like that word. How about artists? Let's go with artists. A lot of people who came out to the show that heard about it on my show were painters who painted me talking and then came to see my partner's paintings at Gallery LaLong. But I'll tell you, man, as somebody who grew up with a mother who painted as a hobby, she painted, but she meant business. She went to graduate school and didn't finish, but she's painting again. I was brought up to like art. I was brought up around art. I was brought up to appreciate art. And I thought of myself as an artist. I did some very cutting edge photographic essays, sophomore year of high school, very provocative, probably way ahead of their time. I did some powerful silkscreen work maybe junior year in graphics class. I also made some business cards for a band. I did Never did any painting, mostly photography, but I did some combined media stuff that never got the attention it deserves. Senior year of high school and some drawing. I did a very, very provocative and cutting edge portrait of John Lennon from the 8x10 that came with the White Album that won a Best of Show award in my high school art show. I'm not tooting my own horn here. I'm just, I got out. You know, I got out just in time before I ruined my life trying to do that, because there are people better at it. And one of them being my girlfriend, Sarah Kane, who does these large abstract paintings. And I started to realize some things about art, or whatever we call art, if I could indulge myself. I've always had a tremendous respect for painters, visual artists, poets. I've always had an envy and respect for people that have the courage to put that much of their creativity into singular objects and things. Like a powerful poem, holy fuck. A powerful painting, what? Punch me in the fucking face. Do it. But sometimes I don't always understand what it is I'm looking at, or why I'm looking at it, or what it represents. And I had sort of a mind-blowing moment looking at Sarah's paintings, because they don't happen unless she manifests them. They are not pulled out of the great collective unconscious, or the strange abstract zone of simplicity beyond things we understand, beyond things that we attach meaning to, beyond ways of speaking. They are pulled out of the universe and onto the canvas by a creative spirit that knows when they're done. That is the true gift of a painter. It's like, I'm done. Anyone else looking at it might be like, how do you know when you're done? Because look at it, it's finished, right? But what does it really mean? There's so, especially with abstract stuff, which is trickier for people to get, or some people just prefer not to. But what you are seeing is you are looking into a portal beyond all understanding. And if it is done properly and with balance and with courage, you are seeing something, you know, at once present and modern and primal at the same time. And it's sort of mind-blowing. It's sort of mind-blowing the risk-taking that's involved. You sort of take a lot of stuff for granted when you look at a painting. You can easily walk by a painting, even the great masterpieces. And sometimes I get a little cynical. Sometimes I get a little defensive. And sometimes I think there's no hope and that nothing fucking matters. And it's easy for me to go like, what's the point? What's the point of art? What's the point of painting? What's it really doing? How is it moving us forward? It's not that, that's not its job. If it could just, you know, blow a couple minds and move through the world that it moved through and get the respect it deserves, it does move the dialogue forward. It does open a portal into the great unknown. It does bring something into the world that did not exist before solely for the fact of a creative expression. And we can't fucking lose that, man. And I also got the opportunity to hang out with one of a favorite artist of mine that I didn't know Sarah knew. I went to the dinner after the opening, and I hung out with Fred Tomaselli, who is this amazing artist who I saw for the first time like back in the 90s. He does these amazing sort of collage-like paintings, but he uses like marijuana leaves, and he uses hallucinogenic drugs in them, and he coats them with a resin, and he creates abstract sort of hallucinatory paintings using all sort of elements of painting and collage and actual pills. And I got to hang out with him for an hour. I never thought that would happen. And we had some pretty deep talks about nicotine delivery systems and power pop. And that's what you talk about when you got time on your hands and you're doing the big work. What do you got going? Well, he happens to be a nicotine gum guy. I'm a nicotine lozenge guy. He kind of wants to make the jump, never tried a lozenge. So I gave the guy that uses drugs in his painting half a nicotine lozenge. I think I might have just changed his life. That said, boy, I'm sort of on a bit of a tear that may or may not make sense. I'll finish it up momentarily. So you know what I did that I didn't know I could do, because I'm sort of old manning a bit, as I said, is I got HBO Go, because I got HBO on Time Warner Cable. Again, these are not paid plugs. This is just my life. And I didn't know I could just get HBO Go. So you know what I've been doing instead of like putting my act together and doing important readings and learning things and expanding my mind, is I'm watching The Sopranos from episode one. You know why? Because I fucking miss it. God damn it. Do you remember when The Sopranos were on and like you'd look forward to Sunday because you didn't have HBO Go and there was no other way to watch it, and you knew that Sunday there'd be a new Sopranos, and if there wasn't, it'd be a sad fucking Sunday. And I'm watching them all. It's fucking great sitting in a hotel room watching The Sopranos when you should be doing other stuff. But what's better than The Sopranos? It's so nice to have those people in my head again because they've already infused into my dreams. It's amazing. What an amazing thing. That The Sopranos changed everything. And I don't need to plug The Sopranos. But before I forget, there's also a spectacular exhibit at the New Museum in New York. I guess I'm going to be art guy. I was going to play guy for a while, but now I guess I'm going to be art guy for a second because the New Museum has this, it's just all these obsessive collections of creative people that infused all sorts of purpose in their creativity, that what they were doing served a specific purpose in terms of their life and keeping it together or warding off spirits. There's almost a mystical element. It's a curated exhibition of specific people that did odd, you know, artistic things and sort of coveted them in series or, you know, in papers or, you know, in collections of photographs. It's pretty fascinating. But on the top floor, there's a series of paintings by a woman named Hilma af Klint. It's a Swedish woman, and Sarah is a huge fan of this woman. I, of course, had never heard of her. And these are these mystical abstracts. Apparently, this woman was a realist painter, and she secretly, way ahead of the game, like in the early 1900s, was doing these abstracts that were sort of attempts at bringing together a mystical system that her and a few other people were working on putting together, a mystical system to explain the great primal forces of the universe in a very simple thing. Because you break it right down, man. This is the thing, is if you move the scrim of garbage aside and just look at the light, you're looking at frequencies, shapes, colors, cohesions through just mystical and some still unknown mysterious forces that remain, you know, unexplained by science and only theorized, that these forces, they propel us and everything we know and don't know through time and through universes. And through these portals, as I said before, you tap in and the truth is simple and it makes everything in the moment that you lock into that canvas or in the moment that you lock into that poem or that you lock into that portal that has been, you know, offered to you by an artist. It suspends and just, you know, devastates every element of our trivial, petty, garbage-filled, distracting, dumb lives. And there you look at the simple truths. Simple truths. In one of those paintings, there's a helix structure 50 years before DNA was even discovered. Why? Because that woman was tapped in to the abstractions that define those mystical forces that move us through all life, all space, right? That's what you get. Did that just exhaust you? Could you still walk by it and not see that? Absolutely. Is it really that simple? Yeah, if you strip it all away and you just deal with those basics. That said, sometimes it's nice just to plow through a pint of ice cream and a Kit Kat and watch The Sopranos on a computer in a hotel room where probably bad things happened. That's all right. That's okay. You can't spend all your time in the abstract. So right now, let's go to my conversation with the lovely Ron Perlman. This conversation definitely has an arc to it. And we definitely get to something. So this is me and Ron Perlman. As I said, you can watch his show on Amazon. Hand of God, season 2 is coming soon. And you can get his book, Easy Street the Hard Way. That's out in paperback now. And you can listen to me and Ron Perlman right now. This is one of these fucking shows, dude, where, like, you know, we live in a world now where people tell me, like, you got to see this show. And I'm like, what's it on? I don't even know what it's on when they tell me. I don't know what they're talking about.
We've overloaded it, right? We fucked up a good thing, didn't we?
I don't know. We went from the golden age of
television to, like, please stop.
I don't even know what it is. It's the golden age of chaos and clusterfuck.
It's employing a lot of people who have no reason, have no right to be employed.
Well, I didn't say that, but
I'm working with some of them.
Isn't this your show? Isn't this your show?
Well, I like to think it is, but then again, I think that of everything I do. When I was on your show, I thought it was my show.
It was your show,
Ron. I made your show my show.
What is this Hand of God business?
Pitch it to me. It's not Hand to God. It's Hand of.
Right.
It's actually unpitchable.
Okay. Great.
Because
I'm in.
It's so dense. It's so dense. Would you like to dense? It's very dense. It's It's very complex.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no way to describe it.
I mean, I could. How long have we got?
As long as you need. You're early.
Okay. Yeah. No. I could. I'm an hour early.
And are you the lead in this show?
I am. I'm number one on the call sheet.
You're number one on the call sheet, but it's a vague show.
It's like my version of Marin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Except you're not Ron.
But I'm Purnell Harris.
Purnell Harris.
I am a judge, of some consequence.
Yeah.
Every street or boulevard in town is named after either my grandfather or my great-grandfather.
Small town.
I'm that guy. San Vicente, California, the fictional town.
Yeah.
Sort of northern California.
Right.
2-hour drive, an hour and a half drive from San Fran.
Right.
And when you meet me in the beginning of our little foray, I am stark naked in broad daylight in a fountain.
So you're a judge with problems.
In a fountain,
yeah.
and I'm speaking in tongues, and I'm taken in, and it turns out I've been missing for 3 days.
Manic episode.
And then it turns out that we find out that my son is lying on life support, having shot himself in the head because he had to watch his wife get raped for an hour. And
this is the opening episode?
We're given to believe that he's in a position where We're being advised to pull the plug.
Right.
So suddenly this man...
This is the first episode?
This is the first episode. This is like old news. This is old. I'm just hipping you to this because, you know...
You're setting it up.
You don't own a TV, obviously.
I own a TV. I don't have the time, Ron. I don't know where people find the fucking time.
Listen, I don't even watch my show.
Yeah, so. I'm watching my show for the first time. I'm finally with... three seasons, I couldn't watch my show for one reason or another.
It's good, though, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I like it.
You're fucking good, man.
Oh, that's sweet of you.
You know, I
you caught me on a good season. This is the fourth one in. I figured it out.
It was figured. It was figured, man. I didn't even break a sweat. And I'm a sweater. I go through boxes of tissues.
We had some good scenes.
We had some nice stuff. You, me, and MC Gainey.
MC Gainey acting way out of character.
I loved the conceit of who it was we were.
Yeah. Sweet.
Really easy to plug into. Very, very, you did all my thinking for me. You as the writer, which pleases me no end. And I didn't have to do anything except, you know, as they say, occupy.
Yeah. Is that what they say?
I don't know. I just said it.
I like it. I'm just present.
I'm throwing shit out. What do I know?
So getting back to, I appreciate the, you know, talking about my show, but this judge is in trouble.
The judge is, for the first time in his life, you know, he's gone from knowing nothing but winning because he's, you know, he's the richest guy in town.
Oh, so on a personal level, he takes this hit.
He's the most powerful guy in town. He lives in the big house, shining house on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
He's got every single motherfucker in town in his hip pocket.
Yeah.
He does a lot of people favors and he fucks up a lot of people. And
is he a corrupt guy?
He has the ability to be. He has a wife. He has a mistress.
Okay.
So he's living the American dream,
right?
You know, and with all its like, you know,
yeah, all the accessories,
the fringes,
yeah, benefits.
And here he is. So it turns out where he was in the 3 days he was missing before he turns up naked, speaking in tongues, is he just kind of went on a stroll and ended up in this church and got saved, found God. And
I felt like I almost felt like I could have been saved 2 days ago.
Really?
I'm through it. I'm okay now. But I realized I understood for some reason for the first time in my life, the idea of sin and the pain of being flawed and why Jesus could work for some people. I mean, I wasn't looking for Jesus, but I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't even know why. I'm not even sure what I was thinking about.
What was there a trigger?
No, but I'm trying to figure out how to structure some stand-up.
Oh, well, that's trigger enough. Anybody who's ever tried to play, you know, the improv.
Right.
The Comedy Store knows that's plenty. That's trigger plenty.
Right. Well, I'm sort of fascinated with the idea of sin as not being like, there was never any, the idea of sin was only designed and constructed to for people to judge themselves against, not to be sinless, but for people to accept sin. And that, you know, that's something that happens. You just want to try and keep it in check. And then when it's not in check, you have to look for the relief or the salvation or the corrective.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you one of these guys that believe that that all of this stuff that we find in the, at the root of civilization, meaning the Bible and
yeah.
the dogma that comes with organized right. religion and all of the bells and whistles, that's an invention so that man could figure out a way to
behave properly,
to forgive himself.
I don't know if it was forgive himself, but I think that it's probably two-tiered, that it was a way for the people that ran the religion to keep people in check, you know, somehow, and also a way to contain a certain amount of power. I don't think it was ever done in earnest. I think that people have to believe in something bigger than themselves to explain the horror of day-to-day life and catastrophe. I don't know if it was to forgive themselves. Christianity seems to have something to do with that. The Jews are not great at that I can really see.
I'm never going to forgive myself for one.
For just being alive?
For
whatever happened this morning?
Just
for the ride over?
Every time I go in the refrigerator.
Right.
It's another reason to
why?
It's another just, you know, foray into self-hatred.
Right. Why? And I think, well, I'm struggling with some of that right now. And to get what I was saying about the sin thing is just that, what I think about those things is that it was pretty clear. Like, the seven deadlies are pretty specific on how human beings can really get themselves fucked up. So, you know, it's a good list.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Food's in there.
These guys were good, man.
Right. It was solid. And just the idea that this entity went through all the pain possible for everybody to sort of use as a barometer for their own pain. I got it. I'm not saying I'm looking for it. I'm completely happy in my recurring pattern of self-defeating and self-hatred with, you know, weird spans of manic excitement that I think are actual change. And then, a month later, I'm like, I guess that was just a good week.
Mm-hmm.
You?
Whew. I mean, you know,
is this too much.
This You're is right no.
You
not
just got out of catering, and yeah, you come over here.
No, this is what I was talking about. This at catering with a donut in my hand. Are you kidding me? With a couple of Teamsters.
Sorry to repeat the conversation.
No, I'm starting to get it.
Yeah.
No, for me, it's like people say, Ron, you know, you need to fucking smell the roses. Calm down. You're so on edge. You're so angry.
Yeah.
You know, what is there to be so angry about? And I said, without that anger, I'd be working in Macy's.
I know, dude. I don't know what to do about it. How are we going to be happy? You work constantly. I was like, I'm going to talk to Ron Perlman and let's take a look at some of the shit he's done. It's like, oh, he's done everything. There's 900 movies. There's 50 fucking TV shows. You work constantly.
I'm right now while I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
I have my phone under the table and I'm writing a script.
Why don't you just take a minute, Ron? Smell the roses. Are you afraid of silence?
Fuck that shit.
Are you afraid of sitting with the silence, Ron?
No, not really. No, I'm really good at you know, lying on the couch.
Are you?
Oh, phenomenal.
Really?
Phenomenal.
Where do you find the time to do that?
I find the time, and it's like the workaholic aspect of
yeah.
it has everything is the only fucking good thing about getting older.
Yeah,
is the perspective is that
right.
is that
start things you, start to you, mean you, less
you,
of a
you,
shit.
Yeah, and also you do start understanding that some of the things that you would have thought were completely unexcusable about yourself and unforgivable about yourself are the very things that make you who you are, that give you your fingerprint.
Yeah,
because there's only one of everybody,
right.
and that if you're lucky enough to get to the point where you feel I'm living the dream, because I have gotten that point. I truly
right.
truly have gotten that point. I am the happiest motherfucker you've ever met.
You're grateful for that? You take that in?
Oh, No. I mean, every single thing that's happening is all stuff that I used to dream about.
Yeah.
And it's all just my reality. It's part of my daily occurrence.
But you don't belittle that or have any, you appreciate it.
I love it.
Good.
I love.
That's a good thing.
I love it. And it's scary because, you know, I'm wired to, like, you know, feel guilty about shit.
Why? Where'd that happen? Let's go back.
Well, I wasn't.
Let's go back.
No, I don't really think. I didn't want to lie down or anything like that, you know,
uh-huh.
like, and get analyzed. But
well, no. But where does that come from? I mean, it's got to come from somewhere if it drove you for that long. You wrote a book. It's got to be in the book.
It's you didn't read the fucking book.
What do you want from me?
I know you're a busy guy.
It's not that I'm busy. I figure, like, if you're going to tell me a story, the problem with reading books thoroughly when I have a guest is then I lead. The, you know, then I know what the answers are.
Well, let me tell you then. So in chapter one,
I like the cover. You look mean and angry, and you're smoking a cigar, mm-hmm. and I'm compelled by it.
It's a great cover. It's a great cover. It's a great cover.
And
it was a shoot I was doing for the cover of Cigar Aficionado.
Yeah,
and we borrowed one of the pictures that came out of that shoot because it's me with a cigar in my hand. Obviously, it's for a fucking cigar magazine. And we used it as a placeholder for my cover of my book.
You don't smoke them no more, right?
I don't smoke them.
Because we had these conversations on set when we were doing my show.
No, I gave them up.
I had one yesterday.
Yeah. No, I can smoke them, but I had to stop because I was using them very nefariously.
What does that mean? Constantly?
Not in a Bill Clinton kind of way.
No, I know, but like you couldn't stop.
I was inhaling.
All day long.
Every puff. Mm. And I was chain smoking. And so.
You got it. You got the bug.
Oh, I could, first thing in
compulsive
the morning.
Compulsive guy.
First thing in the morning and the last thing at night was a big pull off a cigar.
I got a fucking nicotine lozenge in my mouth now, right now.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's great. But I'm clean. I'm sober. I have gone beyond it. I can now actually smoke a cigar in a scene in a movie and not get a Jones.
Oh, yeah?
To start up again.
Do you do anything else? Do you drink or do?
Only socially. No.
No weed.
No weed, no.
Not even socially?
No.
No pills?
No.
Wow.
I mean, you know, Crestor, 66.
Sure.
You know.
How about food?
That's my thing.
Yeah.
That's the one. If there was an AA for food, I'd be in it.
They have it. What are you kidding?
They have it, right?
No way? Yeah. I have food issues too, dude. Where'd you get yours?
Lower middle class, Jewish.
Right.
Eat something, darling. You're not eating enough. You know, they were always worried about you,
right.
You know, about you weren't eating enough.
And it was like back in the day, it was probably like, here, have a plate of kishki. Have some fucking kasha varnishkas. You can't find that shit anymore.
I may actually go straight to Nate and Al's from here now that you mentioned
it. That's got to be the only place that has it.
Stuffed derma is what they
do. Right.
It's the same thing, right?
I think Cantor's has it, but when I see it, like, it's a rare treat and it's tasty, mm-hmm. but like, who's eating it for it to be sitting there? How long has it been sitting there, fucking Cantor's?
You'd be surprised.
Oh, what? That people
I think
eat
the
it?
Kishka moves.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah.
There's still a few guys?
I think the good news about Cantor's and Nate and Al's is that that shit still moves.
It's only guys like you, second generation immigrant Jew guys. Who the hell, your parents' age, they're not around anymore.
Can I tell you my story? I have a house account at Nate and Al's. So when I was a young kid, my dad's biggest year was $12,000. That was the biggest year he ever had. And, I mean, we were like, you know, we were like Bernie Sanders in training, mm-hmm. you know, like socialist left wing, you know.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, on a Sunday when my dad was feeling flush, which was very rarely, he would bring home this stuff called kippered salmon, which is
baked
salmon.
That's not the smoked ones, right?
Yeah,
that's the fresh fish.
It's smoked,
the smoked kipper,
it's smoked
right.
salmon. They call it kippered salmon. They used to have all these great what do they call them? Appetizing stores in New York City.
Like Russ and Daughters.
Yeah, Russ and Daughters, like Zabar's.
Yeah.
And this is where you got that kind of
stuff. And that's high-end shit.
But he would bring home for a family of four a strip that was basically a quarter of a pound with eight bagels.
Yeah.
So two each.
See, it really...
And he'd spread this shit out so thinly.
With cream cheese, right?
Well, I liked mine with butter. But my promise to myself was if I ever make a living, the first thing I'm going to do is buy a piece of kippered salmon bigger than a quarter of a pound and put as much on a fucking bagel as I fucking can until I can't get my mouth around it.
Yeah.
So cut to, I get my first show in the 80s, Beauty and the Beast.
Big show.
Start making some money for the first time. I call up Nate and Al's because I'm here in Hollywood, and I say, what day do you get your fish delivery? Because it comes from Zabar's, their fish.
Does it?
Yeah. It comes from the same place Zabar's comes from. And they say it comes in Thursday.
They ship it all the way across country?
They fly it in. So I show up around 3:30 on a Thursday. There's nobody in the restaurant. And Al, who, of Nate and Al's, who's passed away now for at least 15, 20 years, he's at this cash register. It's between lunch and dinner, so there's nobody in the fucking restaurant. I go in there, I order a pound and a half of kibbutz salmon, I get some chopped liver, I get some bagels, I get some pickles and stuff like this. And I said, I said, by the way, I would like to open a house account. And from and I'm at the counter, so Al is like 20 feet away at the cash register. And I hear Al say, no, no, no house accounts. No, we can't do it. We can't do it. No house accounts. Sorry, you look like a perfectly nice fella. I can't, the paperwork is choking me. It's killing me. No, no house accounts. I said, okay, okay, Al, okay. No problem, I'll pay cash.
He says,
look, no offense. You look like a nice fella. I said, no, it's good. It's good, Al, it's good. So anyway, I get about $86 worth of stuff. And you take the bill and the bag, and you walk over to the counter where Al is sitting, and he, you put, he puts the bill on the spindle, and he takes the $100 bill, and he gives me the change, and I start to walk out, and I'm halfway to my car, and I realize I have two 20s, a 10, a 5, three 1s, and some change.
Too much change.
On an $86 bill, and I've given him 100.
Yeah.
So I walk back in, the money's still in my hand, and I said, Al, what's wrong with this picture? And he looks at the change, and then he pulls my bill off the spindle. He looks at the bill. He looks back at the change, and he goes, give this guy a house account. It's the first honest Jew I met in 40 years. So I still have a house account in there now.
Do you go there often?
I do. I like that place.
No, I mean, I grew up kind of...
It's good.
Yeah, I'm a little younger than you, but like it's a very specific thing to find comfort in that food. You got to have it in your past somewhere.
Of course,
you do. I mean, you grew, like I'm saying, you grew up in the real shit.
Yeah. When I was a kid, there was a deli on almost every block.
Right, and people would eat there.
And on every second or third block, there was a really good deli. Now, I mean, they're not there anymore.
It's only because the taste for that stuff is so specific. You know, it was the culture then. You know, now it's like a special thing. And you got, if your grandparents, like if my grandfather hadn't, you know, driven me into the city from Bayonne so he could pick up tongue at Katz's, you know, and built that into my brain, or my grandmother didn't make matzo ball soup and brisket, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know because my generation is the one right after you, and we were the first ones to go, I don't eat that shit.
Yeah.
But where'd you grow up in New York?
Washington Heights.
And what is that? Is that Brooklyn?
No.
Bronx?
It's Upper Manhattan.
It's like near the Bronx.
It's upstate Manhattan.
Almost the Bronx, right?
Washington Heights is so named because it's the highest point in Manhattan. It's where the George Washington Bridge is.
Right, okay.
And George Washington, ergo Washington Heights, stood up there and watched the Hessians as they made their way up New York.
Yeah.
And a decisive battle was fought because he was able to watch the march up because he was perched at this highest point.
Right.
So named Washington Heights.
Glorious history to where you grew up.
Where they put the George Washington Bridge, which I think they're renaming the Chris Christie.
Yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
Shit.
So how many kids in your family?
Siblings and stuff?
Yeah.
I had a brother.
Yeah.
Passed away very young. He was 38 years old. Jazz musician.
Really?
Yeah.
What happened?
Struggled a long time with manic depression.
Ugh.
Was found dead.
Right.
Not a pretty story.
So you got that in your family, the depression?
I guess so.
Yeah.
I mean, if you'd read the fucking book, you'd understand.
Why you got to say it like that? Why can't we just tell? Why can't we have a conversation about your life?
Here's why. Because I admire you. God
damn it.
I
admire you too. But you know what? The only time I read books is when I'm nervous about talking to the person. I don't.
Oh, that's a great thing to say. I appreciate that. That's a very great compliment. But here's why it's important to me.
I'm going to read it eventually.
Here's why it's important to me. I'll tell you why it's important to me.
Christ.
And you know.
You want to come back another day?
I'm not a... I mean, does that mean I got to leave now?
Maybe. What are you going to say?
No, I got more shit. I got a lot of shit.
I know you
especially
do.
Especially because you didn't read the book. Now I got to tell you the whole fucking
that's
thing.
That's exactly the point of a conversation.
But the thing of it is that... the reason I'm here... reason I'm here... is because of a guy named Phil Stutz.
Okay. Yeah, the therapist. I love Phil Stutz. How's he doing? Is he all right?
Phil Stutz, he and I worked for years and years and years. I haven't spoken
to
him.
Did he fix your brain?
He fixed me. I mean, I'm a graduate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I go to him now,
mm-hmm.
it's usually maybe twice a year, and it's mostly...
Tune up.
It's mostly, you know, every once in a while, you still go to territory where you really have never been before and don't know quite how to maneuver your way around it.
Really? Within yourself?
In the world, not within myself. But yeah, in applying...
How to handle something.
How to handle... Because the thing that was brilliant about Stutz why the interview you did with him on the show, which I guess was inspired by
Hank Azaria,
a book that he wrote called The Tools.
Well, Hank Azaria had brought him up and did an impression of him, and then the woman who was the publisher of my book published Phil's book, sent it to me, and I said, of course.
Phil what happened when your mother did this to you, and you know, like the conversation you and I were about to have about why I eat the way I do,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there's a fucking reason. I'm sure that there was
You know there's a reason.
I'm sure that there's...
Why do a disservice to you? There is.
No, but why? What good does it do?
I'll tell you why. You want to know...
To go back to that moment where you've realized that all the other shit you couldn't get in this life... And you were 3 years old, you could finally get from a piece of white Wonder Bread with mayonnaise on it.
Mm-hmm. Good does that do? That's a very touching image. I would think that'd be a great resource creatively, that moment when you feel that.
You could be right.
All right, but Phil.
I'm going to leave the door open for you to be partially right on that.
Well, I just had an experience yesterday that speaks differently to this. You know, that I had a realization yesterday around food. My mother was the opposite. She was a not eater. She was an anorexic person.
Oh.
So what I grew up with, you know, you're unlovable if you're fat, you know, if you put on weight, you know what I mean? So, like, I had body image issues from the get-go because my mom was so afraid of fat that she couldn't handle it in herself, and my entire childhood was based on denying me food. And I was a chubby kid, so, like, she literally said to me recently, I don't think I could love you if you were fat. That's in the last decade. But what I'm telling you is that I went back yesterday to the moment.
That's a giveaway, by the way. That she would say something like that. That there's a good chance she just fundamentally can't.
No, I know. She said that, too. She said that, like, in passing, sort of like a jokingly at Thanksgiving one. She goes, you know, Mark, when you were a baby, I just didn't know how to love you. And I'm like, holy shit, there's the missing piece. But the moment yesterday where I realized that she was incapable of it because she was so insecure in her own self.
Mm-hmm.
It's a powerful moment. And then you can let them off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cognitive shit's fine. Yeah, you learn how to live your life. But the moment where you can actually let go of some shit or feel the grief or the sadness of it, that's not nothing.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, I was about to say the genius of Stutz is that he actually, the name of his book, The Tools, the genius of his therapy is that in the 55 minutes or 50 minutes that you're in session with him.
Yeah.
Whatever I ever brought in 50 minutes, I was beyond it. And simply because there was no exercise in going backward and trying to deconstruct something so that you deconstruct it so you can build up on it again, which is why classical therapy usually takes years and years and years.
Doesn't work necessarily.
Yeah. His thing was, okay, here's your problem.
Yeah.
Do this, this, and this.
Yeah.
Close your eyes,
mm-hmm.
and he gives you an exercise, and then maybe he gives you a second one, maybe even a third one, depending on how profoundly deep this shit is.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk out and you go, I just, not only did I get past it, I have wiped the slate clean, and I'm fucking empowered now.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing conceit until you get to the next one.
Right.
But if you get to all of the triggers,
yeah,
and you get enough tools to sort of... redirect your misinformation, which is coming from the short circuiting of your inability to cope with something on your own,
mm-hmm.
and you get a tool that immediately totally redirects it,
sure,
and manages it in a way where something that was suicidal and negative and dark, all of a sudden becomes celebratory and beautiful.
Yeah.
So he has this thing which this will tie into everything we're talking about, called the shadow.
Yeah.
Which is one of his tools. And this was the hardest one for me to get to because I have such an aversion to wanting to go back to the original sin. But the shadow is that kid with the piece of white bread and mayonnaise on it, eating it where he didn't want anybody to see him because it was so, like, the everything that you have, that you find as the, at the root of all of your self-loathing,
the shame
is the shadow. That's the shadow.
Got it.
You, and you know, if you do this therapy diligently, you summon the shadow. Summoning the shadow took me fucking years because I was so resistant to it. But finding that kid, finding my little kid that was like so in need of being said, hey, you know, it's good. You're good, man. You got, check this out, you know. And it came from, okay, you identify it, and then you treat it as if it's your own child, and you're going to give it unconditional love and support to the point where you make it feel beautiful. And now you are in control of the kid because you're taking care of it, and you're telling it, and you're also at peace with the fact that that very thing that used to cause you all this discomfort and self-loathing and lack of esteem and everything is the very thing that makes you fucking beautiful.
Right.
That's, you know, that's...
Yeah, it's overcoming shame.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but it still sounds like on some level, what?
Simple exercise, though. Simple right. exercise.
Right.
I mean, I just described it to you. You can do it now.
Sure, that you can repeat. The real trick becomes, if you're used to being, an aggravated, compulsive, you know, cycling guy, like if that's your baseline, mm-hmm. you know, aggravated,
mm-hmm.
there's a certain comfort in that. You know, it may not seem comfortable when you're in it, but that's home to you. So when you leave home, you're like, hey, I feel pretty good. Fuck that. Fuck
right.
that.
Right.
So that's a tricky thing.
That's a problem.
Right. But it's different than what you're saying, because like what we opened the conversation with was that who am I without the anger?
Right.
Right.
So, no, I won't give up the anger.
Right.
I'll never give up the anger. I'll never give up the righteous indignation. Because I'm totally convinced that that's where all of my genius comes from. All of it.
But you're also happy, though, so that we got to qualify that.
Incredibly happy. And the anger, which is always right, ready to pounce.
I know, me too. Right?
Constantly. I mean, right next to me.
Right, but so how is that like, you know, you've dealt with your shit, you're good. If the anger is right here, like, I could trigger it, I don't know how, but
What's not to be angry about?
No, I get that.
Look at the world we're living in, man. I mean, I happen to be a news junkie, now I'm having to look at this shit.
Yeah, but the world that you're living in is, you like to lay on the couch, you're working all the time, people know you, you're
No, my shit's cool.
Fine. Well,
I'm talking about, I'm talking about, you know, there's this a civic awareness.
I tend to avoid this child
hunger, and
I know.
And people, you know, being profiled, and you know,
no, I know. So you grew up with a social awareness, like you bring up your father, you know, were they Jewish socialists?
No. My dad was an agnostic. My dad had
an
active disdain for religion.
Right. What did he do?
He was a fundamentally a musician.
Mm-hmm.
He stopped being a musician before I was born because he decided that he needed to be responsible now that he was a dad,
mm-hmm.
and started to go door to door fixing people's televisions, broken televisions, back in the day when people had picture tubes and tubes and shit.
So he's on-call TV repair dude.
He was an on-call TV repair dude. He charged $3.
Did he regret
a house call?
Not being a musician anymore?
He never seemed to. We had a piano in the house. He taught himself how to play trumpet, and we would come home from these back-breaking, arduous days.
Yeah,
and then play for hour and a half.
He was able piano to enjoy it
before dinner.
Ah,
and by the time he sat down at dinner, he was like the savage beast who had been soothed.
Wow! So he used his passion as a meditative, beautiful hobby.
He seemed to have an amazing balance.
That's great.
Amazing balance, without any of the self obsessed
bitterness
claptrap that guys of our generation are fucking going through. I mean, I feel like there was so much less self indulgence
or entitlement
with those guys that came up a generation before me.
They had to feed the kids.
That's a couple of generations before you. But, you know, when you hear guys like Brokaw talk about the greatest generation, you know, the World War II guys.
Was your dad in the war?
He was in the Army. He was never in combat, but he was in the Army during World War II.
Yeah.
And his experience was shaped by being a Depression baby, number one.
Yep.
And somebody who, sacrificing whatever plans you had in order to go serve your country was not even something you thought twice about.
Right.
And then getting on with it afterwards, not sitting around and indulging in, you know, like the horrors that I've seen. And,
right.
You know,
right.
I knew a lot of guys who actually did serve, and who somehow
of your generation, you mean, or his?
A little, slightly older. Like, yeah. I got to be very close with Charlie Durning, who was
a great actor.
He was one of the most decorated soldiers in the history of this country, who turned into an actor.
Charles Durning was?
He landed on Omaha Beach.
Really? I didn't know that.
He lost 38 guys, his greatest friends around him, or something like that.
And
he took out a machine gun nest, and he carried 12 people to safety, and, you know, on his back, and then he turned into this fucking beautiful, bright song and dance guy who,
great actor,
who spread joy into everybody's lives for decades and decades. And right before I got to work with him a lot, but the last time I worked with him, he would just suddenly sit there in the chair waiting for them to light a shot, and he would just break into tears, and he was trying to finally purge the stuff that he held in for all those years.
Yeah.
Because if you ever touch, you ever say, yeah, I heard you were on Omaha Beach, he would change the subject. And then right before he died, and I've seen this with other veterans, he needed to get it all out. Mm. And he couldn't stop him from talking about it.
Oh, really?
You couldn't stop him from talking about how he never slept more than 2 hours a night, and his wife would have to hold him in his arms while he sobbed because of what he saw at Normandy. So they had PTSD, but it wasn't a thing, these World War II guys. I don't understand.
It wasn't labeled. Well, it was a thing.
It was a thing, but it was, but somehow was what I don't. I'm obsessed with this, Mark. I just have to figure out what it is about these newest, latest wars that we have guys, you know, 23 a day, almost one an hour. You know, getting to the point where they whatever it was they
saw. Well, one of the things that's gone is that not a second thought about serving your country, that it's a choice and that it's an occupation. And some of these guys are coming from, you know, relatively desperate situations.
Mm-hmm.
The war, it does not necessarily have public support anymore or even have anything to do with, you know, the integrity of America.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, like, a lot of these guys are going in and it's an ill-defined agenda.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not coming home, you know, with the decorated heroes, with the country support. And, you know, if it wasn't for you guys, we'd all be in trouble kind of thing.
And they're not fighting other guys in uniforms. They're
fighting, they don't know what they're walking into.
They're fighting people that are holding up babies as shields.
Oh, that started in Vietnam, that stuff, that whole tone.
Well, that's when it all turned real dark.
Yeah.
And that's when war was no longer this thing that you associated gallantry and nobility and all those other kind of abstract words. But those were the words that were associated with our efforts to protect our liberties.
Well, you must have been of age for Vietnam, no?
I was.
What happened?
I basically didn't see any logic in our engagement in Vietnam.
Right.
I didn't see anything noble about it.
Were you an actor at that point already?
No, I was just getting out of college.
Uh-huh.
And it was the one lottery that I won.
Uh-huh.
Because the year that I became eligible is when they went from a straight draft to a lottery draft, where they would draw birthday numbers,
right,
and then if you were in the top, say 250, you were fucking going. If you were in the bottom 165 or 135, whatever was left of birthdays, you probably weren't going to get called.
Yeah.
I got number four. I won big. And we had a thing. I won't go into great detail, but, you know, we were hippies.
Yeah.
We were fucking, you know, tuning in and turning on and tuning out.
Where were you?
I was at Lehman College in the Bronx.
So everybody's long hair.
Everybody's smoking dope. Everybody's dropping acid. Everybody's listening to, you know, to the Beatles, going to fucking ashrams and shit. And, you know,
did you have a good time?
Transcendental. I had a great. I was discovering theater, but I was also kind of politically aware, and I was part of the '60s thing where
you were active.
Yeah, there was a kind of a everything seemed to be even my involvement in theater. See, was somehow interweaved with
activism.
The times that were a-changing.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, that was the
theater time. Was very experimental. Everything.
What were you doing, like Julian Beck shit?
Well, that was happening, and we were studying it, and we were trying to figure out where that came. That didn't happen to be my cup of tea. It turned out I was more inclined to more classic, more traditional type things, but I was trying everything. And
what were your first ventures into theater at that time? Must have been pretty wild shit.
No, because most of my theater exposure was through school.
Okay.
So whatever the school was doing, I was in high school plays, college plays, got $7,000 worth of parking tickets by going to Lehman College in the Bronx, and then decided to go to grad school in Minnesota because I figured the cops would never look for me there. And I really did.
What graduate program? Where?
University of Minnesota.
Doing acting?
Doing MFA, yeah, Masters of Fine Arts for acting, yeah.
Which was that a good program?
It was a great program. It was Minneapolis, St. Paul is
great. Love it.
Highly cultured region.
Even then, huh?
Very much so.
Yeah.
The Guthrie Theater was there.
I just did a show there.
The Walker Arts Center. You know, people have a lot. There's some money in that town. There's a lot of 3M was there.
But sophisticated cultural people.
A lot of corporate headquarters, so there were a lot of wives who had a lot of time on their hands, who had money, and they shoved it all into the arts.
Mm-hmm.
So there were museums, there were galleries.
Oh, yeah.
There were theaters all over the place, community theaters all over the place. So there was no lack of someplace to go apply your wares.
So when you do the MFA there, you do all of it. You do the Shakespeare, you do the dance, you do the movement, mm-hmm. you do sword fighting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You do a clown workshop.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do clown work?
My dad used to accuse me of doing anything for a laugh. He said, you'd break a fucking leg to get a laugh, wouldn't you?
You were that guy, huh?
I was that guy. He said, you'd do anything for a laugh. Tone it down.
That's funny, because a lot of your roles are a little heavier than that.
I started off doing stand-up.
No.
First thing I ever did in show business was stand-up.
Where?
In the Bronx.
For real?
For reals.
Like, did you do the improv? Or?
No, I never got that far. I only did other people's shit.
Oh.
You know, I never evolved to the point where I wrote my own stuff.
This?
I basically mostly did George Carlin's act.
Uh-huh. Where?
Started off locally, and then wherever discotheque there was around, we would go, we would audition, and they would say, yeah, you could do a couple nights here.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Just... My last gig was on Arthur Avenue in the Bronx.
Oh, yeah, it's where all the Italian restaurants are.
Yeah, and we got heckled. And
who's we?
I had a partner. Spencer Schwartz was my partner.
You were doing the comedy team?
And Ron Perlman, Spencer Schwartz, on stage, we were Stewart and Perry.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't cool to be, you know...
Your names?
Schwartz and Perlman.
Right.
So anyway, we get heckled, and we heckled back, and all of a sudden, you know, about 40 guys...
made guys.
Started for the stage. And we bolted
last night. That was
we found
final
out there
performance?
Was a back door. There was luckily a cab waiting, and that was my final.
That was
my
it.
Final
your farewell to comedy.
And the only reason I went into legitimate acting is because, you know, like the old John Wayne joke. Who's doing? You know, he's apparently doing Julius Caesar in some town in Pennsylvania, and some woman is snoring in the front row, and he turns to her and he goes, hey, lady, I didn't write this shit. So that's why I went into legit theater, so that I could say, hey, you know, if the play bombs, it's not my fault. Some fucking jerk writer wrote this shit.
Right. So when you started doing theater in New York, like what were you doing? I mean, were you doing La Mama and that kind
of...
You were.
Yeah. So I grew up all through New York, go high school, start acting in high school, act all my way through college, 2 years of grad school. So there's 8 years of stage. finish grad school and then say, okay, you got to go back to New York. You can't keep running away from this. I threw down.
You feel like you were running away from it?
I thought I tried to run away from it as long as I could, because every professional actor I knew had a horrific life. They were all living on spaghetti and, you know, in cold water flats and, you know, struggling to pay the bills.
But what'd you go to undergrad for? Was it for what'd you think you might?
I loved.
I know, but like, did you have a plan B, or there, like another idea?
Well, the problem was there was never a plan B. So
right.
Eventually,
that's not the problem. That's
eventually you gotta make
figure it out.
You know, stand and deliver, or you know, move off.
So you moved back to New York.
Moved back to New York. My buddy had a boutique in Greenwich Village. Worked for him. He let me go whenever I had a play, whenever I had an audition.
What year are we talking, 70s?
73 to 80.
Exciting place, New York, at that time, huh?
Incredibly exciting place.
Was it all broken?
It was very much in transition.
Yeah.
You know, because the 60s were giving way to something no one quite knew what it was. Turned out it was AIDS.
Yeah.
Bankruptcy. Yeah, it turned out all these hippies turned into yuppies and you know whatever it was we were fucking, you know,
fighting for,
revolting against, yeah.
Just absorbed you
was just a big wank, uh-huh, you know, and uh-huh. I think
so. What kind of theater were you doing in the '70s?
I was doing a lot of classics. I really loved. I got very lucky. Because I met a professor at Lehman College,
yeah,
who brought me through from Aeschylus to Sam Beckett and everything in between.
Yeah.
Like the entire history of
theater. So you were a full-on theater guy.
Theatrical literature.
It wasn't about movies, really. You wanted to be a stage actor.
But it was about the literature of theater.
The art.
The literature.
Yeah.
Not the art. The art came later. The literature of theater.
Yeah.
Like... what the Greeks started doing, and then, you know, everything that they died.
Yeah.
Only to be replaced by something else, then they died. But through every phase of history, there has been theatrical literature.
Yeah.
Up until now, there's hardly anybody writing plays anymore because you can't make a living doing it.
I just talked to a couple guys. There's some good shit around.
There's some good shit around. But you know, arguably... we're not living in an age where people like Tennessee Williams, Eugene O'Neill, Samuel Beckett, Gunter Grass, William Inge, Edward Albee are all walking the earth at the same time.
Right.
When I was learning my value system, all those guys were not only walking the earth, but they were Harold Pinter. They were what people had to aspire to, had to look up to.
Yeah.
We don't live in a condition right now that supports that particular kind of... And my theory is, it's not because a Tennessee Williams isn't being born every 5 minutes. It's just that, his ability to get to the marketplace has been completely stultified.
That's true.
So he has to go find a way to do something to keep his lights on, and that usually means he's going to be working at FX or Amazon or... And thank God for those places, mm-hmm, because right now that's where all the great literature is.
It was definitely, what I've learned from talking to people that lived through this and yourself included is that it was a much more intimate business, and in the sense of outlets. And people who were truly gifted and full-on geniuses that did the work were celebrated more because of that intimacy. You know, now the whole thing is broken open. There's a million different outlets. There's the issue of corporate occupancy of the arts and very little public support in a lot of ways. And there's just thousands of people doing things, and they can do it on their own. But back then, if someone came up through the ranks and all of a sudden there was a play and it had to be reckoned with, it was reckoned with. It was a small community.
Because there was an edifice into which it could plug into.
Yep.
And it was a thriving edifice, you know.
But it was also a small, you know, it was like, you know, I think that the politics of the business and sort of the competition was always there, and there was even less opportunity. So the motherfuckers that got through had to be real fucking geniuses.
But that's true of any generation.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
However, what is not true of every generation is what's happening now is that the edifices have all been ripped away, including the record industry. Like, I have a kid who She recorded her first album of 10 songs that she wrote. And if she had done that literally 2 years earlier, she'd have been signed. They would have given her $3 million, $1 million to make the album, mm-hmm. another $1 million to turn her into a brand name, and a third $1 million to send her out into the world on tour. And by the time all those three things happened, if she was meant to be a star, she was going to be a star. And they had a revenue stream.
Yeah. It's all broken open now.
There's no edifice. It's become so difficult to sort through, because there's always been 55 layers of garbage before you get to Stevie Wonder.
Right, but somebody was in charge of sorting through that.
Right.
Now we all just have to do it
freely. And there was a place where somebody would be playing something and all of a sudden they'd hear, you know, for once in my life, and they'd go, holy shit,
yeah,
get him on the fucking phone.
Right.
And all of a sudden the world has Stevie Wonder, and not just you and me, because we happen to catch him on YouTube, but the fucking world has Stevie Wonder, and he's filling stadiums all over the world.
So you're doing the classics, you're in New York.
And I'm still doing the classics.
Yeah. But you had an amazing career, so like I'm just trying to, like, you know, how did you come to Hollywood? What happened? So you're doing theater in New York. What was the break? Because it seems like you were eating a lot of shit for a few years.
Yeah. I mean, I had sporadic moments of sublimeness
on stage
throughout my whole young life.
Yeah,
sporadic moments of sublimeness. Met a guy right after I got out of school named Tom O'Horgan.
Yeah,
and Tom O'Horgan was known for Hair, Jesus Christ Superstar, Lenny. He directed all those things.
Oh yeah,
I caught him in his waning days.
Mm-hmm.
But we made some noise, and so, the play that we did got a huge amount of
notoriety. Which play?
It was called The Emperor and the Architect of Assyria, or The Architect and the Empress of Assyria. It was a very, very angry, expressionistic Spanish play by a guy named Fernando Arrabal.
Mm-hmm.
But we fucking set the town on fire in New York, got rave reviews.
What year was that?
76.
Oh, that's exciting.
And so from that I got... an equity card. From that, I got my first agent and everything like that. And then nothing for 3 years. And
I thought you were going to go. This is it.
Yeah. And then 1979, I get called in to do this audition where I'm supposed to try to act like a Neanderthal. And so I cavalierly go and I treat the fucking director because he's French, and he seemed like he was wearing jeans that were ironed.
Yeah,
you know.
So you're full of the hate.
Do you iron your jeans?
No.
Do you have like a crease in the front of your jeans?
No.
This motherfucker had creases in the front.
Those are dry, clean jeans, my friend.
He was a Frenchman. He had a sweater tied around his shoulders.
So you got the right attitude going into this.
He had perfect hair.
Uh huh.
And he was French. Uh-huh. And he was doing a fucking caveman movie, and all I could think of was Victor Mature and Virginia Mayo in 2000 BC, where she's wearing, you know,
loincloth
and eyeshadow, he's perfectly shaved,
right? Yeah,
with great hair,
yeah.
And so I cavalierly went through this whole audition process, and the day they flew me to London for the final audition, I find out that this Frenchman had won the Academy Award for Black and White in Color for Best Foreign Film, and that he was a serious motherfucker.
Yeah.
And on the last audition, I finally got nervous, but I hadn't blown it. I didn't get so nervous that I blew it. They gave me the part. It was called Quest for Fire, my first movie, 20th Century Fox.
It's a big movie.
Huge budget for the time, for 1980. Academy Award winning filmmaker. Do the movie. It's got Anthony Burgess, who wrote Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
He's writing the glossary. It's got the greatest anthropologist in the world. He's setting up the world for us. It's just teeming with class and teeming. It's got Ray Don Chong. It's teeming with integrity.
Yeah.
It's teeming with. Yeah. It's the most serious look anybody's ever taken at 80,000 years ago. What that might have looked like.
Right.
And it's not playing. It's not fucking playing. And we do the movie, rave reviews, get a couple of nominations. Nothing happens for 3 years.
Again. 3 years. Nothing.
Then that same dude who did Quest for Fire comes back and hands me this another fucking trippy gem called The Name of the Rose.
But Quest for Fire was like, that was real. There was no English in that.
No, there was no,
I mean, it was like you were.
It was like a silent film.
But that's
with,
hard acting.
With sound. Yeah, it was hard.
You had to, like, you had to draw from all your resources.
No, I'm telling you, it was a sublime,
I know,
artistic endeavor.
Yeah.
Which was received in a beautiful way, but there wasn't a commercial success.
Right.
None of the things I were doing were commercial successes, including the thing at La Mama. But the people who I cared about, you know, their opinion, they were going, holy shit, this is some trippy shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was plenty for me.
Yeah.
Then 3 more years, and then he decides he's going to do The Name of the Rose, which was, like, for 200 weeks, number one bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah.
Umberto Eco, and a lot of people were trying to do the movie.
Yeah.
And he gives me this role of the Hunchback, which is almost as colorful as the one in Notre Dame.
Right.
And it's Sean Connery's in it, and
what was that like working with him?
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. I mean, you have certain expectations of your true heroes,
because
you don't have that many heroes.
Yeah,
guys from that generation are the only guys who could ever be in the category of heroes for me anyway.
Yeah,
you know, the Sean Connery, he was the end of all the guys who were larger than life. He was the last bastion of that. And when you meet a guy like that and he doesn't disappoint, that he's a real fucking OG. He doesn't suffer fools. He drinks hard. He plays hard. You know, he lives hard, and he loves to laugh and sit there and have a great time. But when they say action, he's like Michelangelo. You know, so that was thrilling.
Yeah,
thrilling. So Name of the Rose happens.
Would be received?
Very, very beautifully by the press. Didn't make a lot of money, but it broke even, like most of my shit. And then Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. That's how everyone knows you.
Yeah, goes for 2.5 years, primetime CBS. The show finally ends. The phone literally doesn't ring for 3 fucking years.
Why do you think that is, Ron?
I don't know. I just
the nature of the business?
I think I would be immodest if I even tried to address that or answer that.
Right.
But I think it has something to do with the fact that none of those things were indicative of making me saleable.
Right.
For sure. None of those things were indicative of saying, oh, this is the guy who's going to be doing this for the rest of his life, you know? Because each one of those were kind of one-offs.
And also you get cast as, not necessarily a heavy, but a heavy presence. You have a certain intensity and look to you,
but none of them were sort of said, he'll be the best friend of the lead for the rest of his career.
Right.
He'll be Zach Galifianakis.
Right.
You see most people and you go, oh yeah, he's going to be that guy.
But did you want that?
Well, I thought I did, because having the phone not ring for 3 years and always being on the verge of selling your house.
Yeah.
You know, or pulling your kids out of fucking school, you know, that's not fun.
Scary.
It's not fun. It's just not fun. So what I really wanted was some sort of seat at the table and some sort of feeling that everything wasn't always going to be complete feast or famine.
Especially after 50, like you did like 55, 60 episodes of that thing, of Beauty and the Beast. So you banked a little money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just enough to get into trouble.
Right.
And just enough to buy my first house and then, you know.
And then
not
wait.
Work for 3 years.
So were you like...
After I made my first down payment.
And you got a wife and 2 kids at that point?
Yeah. Wife and, yeah, the second kid got born the year they canceled Beauty and the Beast.
Now, but what kind of guy are you when that happens? Do you freak out? Are you yelling at your agent?
I call Phil Stutz.
That was when he started with Stutz.
I call my shrink. I say, how do I do this? And there were times where I really didn't have the resources, where I was in total panicsville, where I was like, getting ready to throw everything overboard, you know, where I was like, I don't know, Never did I think about getting out of the business because I
what are you going to do?
What am I going to do, first of all? And what am I ever going to do that gives me the thrill that this thing gives me, that sort of engages me in, you know, all my cylinders are pumping when I'm doing it.
Right.
There's nothing that even ever came close to that.
But so, you're still doing, you know, parts in movies at that time, right?
Yeah,
little parts
yeah.
here and there.
Things that I would rather not have been in, you know, things that I'm not proud of.
Yeah.
You know, things that just...
Work.
You know, yeah, you know, just shit work. And then I met Guillermo del Toro, and I've been steadily working ever since.
Yeah.
He actually was the one that changed my life for, I finally got momentum and it has lasted.
And you credit him exactly? Like he's the guy?
Credit him exactly. He's the fourth leg of the stool.
Uh-huh.
There was Stutz.
Yeah.
There's the guy in college, Arzamanian, who taught me how to love literature. There's Jean-Jacques Annaud, who gave me Quest for Fire and Name of the Rose and Enemy at the Gates.
Yeah.
And then there's Del Toro. And, you know, there's like any one of those people in somebody's life that is that much of a game changer for you, where you're completely going in one direction and all of a sudden the whole direction changes.
It changes your whole perception.
Any one of them is a good thing to have in the arsenal of living a life. But to have, you know, four people who had that much of an impact and continue to.
Yeah.
That was when I realized, holy shit, Perlman, you know, you know whatever little moments of discomfort, you are a very, very lucky dude.
Yeah. And how did he directed
directed a little movie called Kronos.
Right.
It was his first film.
Yeah.
1992 or three or something, whatever it says there. And that was when, after Beauty and the Beast, that was the first job I did in 3 years.
Yeah.
But his coming out party was for real. This was a filmmaker that the world was going to stand up and take notice to. And everybody realized from his first movie, this little tiny little weird vampire movie,
that he was going to
leave behind a body of work,
uh-huh.
an important body of work.
Yeah.
And not only did we have a great working relationship, but we turned into great pals. And then he did this 7-year battle with a studio and a half. Because for 5 years it was at one studio, and he kept saying Ron Perlman, they kept saying Nick Cage, he kept saying Ron Perlman, they kept saying The Rock, he kept saying Ron Perlman. It was Hellboy. And it took him 7 years, but he finally won me the role and got the picture made.
And now no one can see it as anybody else.
Yeah, but I mean, that was like, I don't know, I've never seen anything quite like that before, where somebody could have made his movie 20 times over.
Yeah.
He could have made his movie 20 times over, but just by going, yeah, all right, I this is a losing battle. I was saying to him,
take it,
dude. You're not gonna get the movie made this way.
Yeah, you know,
give me a small part. You know, let me be an FBI agent or something.
Yeah.
But he did that, so that was a game changer. And then Hellboy 2, and you know, and then Sons of Anarchy. Everything sort of started. One thing started leading into another, which is what I mean by momentum.
And you're in your 40s.
No, I'm in my 50s.
At that point.
I'm in my 50s.
So doing things you're not proud of, taking whatever you can to stay in the game.
40s was that.
Yeah.
50s was when the momentum started. Life began in a strange way. 50s was my most phenomenal decade.
Thank God.
And the 60s aren't so bad either so far. Knock on wood.
Well, it's like it's amazing because like Sons of Anarchy was huge, got a nice tight following. We're in parking lots shooting my show. People are coming up to you with stuff to sign, dolls,
right.
Lunchboxes. I don't know what the fuck it was.
Right.
People love that show.
Yeah.
Like you locked into something that even in this media landscape where the edifices are limited, where you know one thing you can find that is especially with a show like that and with a personality like yours and is that a very loyal fucking following. Hellboy's the same way. There's a certain group of people that love that fucking movie that probably see it once a year.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And they love you.
No. The fans are, even Beauty and the Beast, the fans were rabid. They were a small number, but they were rabid. They
That's
were
the way it works now. And it's probably better for you that you weren't some sort of, you know, major movie star that had a 5-year window and then became sort of like a, like, what was it like to work with Brando at the point you work with him?
It was, that's something, you know, we're either going to have to do another podcast or you're going to have to read chapters 20.
No, you're going to tell me the story like a fucking Jew.
20 and 21. Well, Brando was, I mean, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, you know, of all the actors who love Brando.
Yeah.
Of all the actors who are obsessed with Brando, of all the actors who try to emulate him and figure out covert ways of homaging him without being caught, no one is bigger than me. Nobody has more revere for that motherfucker than me.
Yeah.
There are others that are kind of tied with me.
Yeah.
But no one has more. So when I heard that he was doing this film and that it was tailor made because it was the Island of Dr. Moreau, so everybody in the film had to be wear these transformational makeups, and that was my thing. That was my wheelhouse. I had already done Quest for Fire, transformational makeup, Name of the Rose, transformational. So I was known, and Beauty and the Beast. So I was known as this guy who liked to work behind rubber,
and we had the patience to go through 20 hours.
Yeah, and that I dug it, and then there was no complaining. There was like, you know,
yeah.
And so I was a shoo-in for this next Marlon Brando movie, which I never imagined I would ever be.
Had you ever met him?
I had never met him.
Oh, my God.
So, Richard Stanley, there's a documentary called Island of Lost Souls, I think.
Right.
Richard Stanley was the genius. He was kind of a low-budget wunderkind who had directed a couple of really cool, edgy, low-budget, stylish movies.
Uh-huh.
New Line, he went to New Line with his newly formed little notoriety. He was kind of an egghead.
Yeah.
He stumbled when he spoke, and he was a very brilliant guy.
Yeah.
But not a battler.
Yeah.
Like a real intellectual.
Yeah. And he's the director.
He goes to New Line and he pitches the notion of doing Island of Dr. Moreau, and they say, "Well, this is fascinating. It's time that we do this because vivisection has suddenly now become." Whereas H.G. Wells wrote about this in 1895,
right.
Now it's actually, cloning is actually on the radar. So
yeah.
Can you get somebody, and he goes to Brando, and Brando says, I will, he watches his movies, and he signs on. Hire everybody, Stan Winston for the makeup, they hire me, they hire, you know, a lot of motherfuckers all over the place. Go to far north Queensland, Australia to start shooting, and on the fourth day, they fired Richard Stanley.
Why?
Because on the fourth day, he was 4 days behind through a series of happenstances that most of which were not his fault. But he got the rug pulled out from under him by some very crafty, shady motherfuckers who did not appreciate him wielding power, you know, on a big thing where he was not ready yet.
Right.
I was still in L.A. I was meant to go out on the next plane. But they said, hold on. We may not be doing the movie. Then I heard rumors that they're not going to do the movie unless they can find a director that Brando approves of.
Mm-hmm.
Then I hear that there's... I'm starting to get emails from director friends of mine like, hey, I got a meeting with Marlon. What should I expect? And I go, I don't know. I never met the motherfucker. But good luck.
Yeah.
Well, what about this movie? I hear it's a clusterfuck. I said, yeah, I hear it's a clusterfuck too, but I've
got my ticket.
I'm 22 hours away by plane, so I don't know what the fuck... I mean, it's all just rumor and conjecture at this point. And then there's this, like one car would be going up to Mulholland Drive while another one was coming down.
To Brando's
house? This steady parade of cars, of directors going up to pitch their version. The guy who ends up getting it is John Frankenheimer.
He's an old-timer?
He was an old-timer. He was exiled from filmmaking. He made very, very big films in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Manchurian Candidate. 7 Days in May, The Train, Birdman of Alcatraz.
Oh, that's good.
But he was an alcoholic.
Right.
And he destroyed his career.
Yeah.
And for 12 years, he went into exile. And the way he came out was he started making these very big miniseries that got all these awards. And suddenly, Richard Stanley's out. We're looking for a director. Frankenheimer goes up to Brando's house, and Brando says,
maybe it's time for you to finally get back what you lost, you know?
And
yeah,
Frankenheimer becomes the director. Frankenheimer goes to Australia. Another couple of weeks go by.
Brando probably knew him, right?
No.
Never met him.
Never met.
Huh.
Another couple of weeks go by, and they say, Pearl, okay, get on the plane, go.
Yeah.
I show up. After about 2 or 3 days, we have our first welcome Marlon party.
Yeah.
Because he's supposed to come on the plane.
Right.
And we had a welcome Marlon party for the next 3 weeks every night, and he never showed. he finally did show up, and...
I can't imagine what you're doing. Like, what the fuck is...
Everybody is like... Everybody, you know, it's like he's like the Wizard of Oz. I mean, yeah. You know, he's like... It's like the, you know, the Dalai Lama.
So part of you is an actor who's like been around John the block, Lennon. Who knows the game, and sort of like, what is this bullshit? But the other part of you is like, yeah, I got to meet Marlon Brando.
That's the only reason I'm here. That's the only reason I'm putting this shit on my face and becoming this fucking, you know, ram with goat with ram's ears.
Yeah.
You know, that's who I'm playing. So I could be there. Yeah. So I could be in his presence, right? So he finally arrives, and let me jump to our first day on the set. We're doing the scene. I'm playing this character out of H.G. Wells called the Sayer of the Law. And he would intone these incantations because he would be the one, if one of these animals stepped out of line, they would have a trial, and he would be the one intoning the laws of these animals that, you know, not to slurp, but to sip.
Right.
That is the law.
Yeah.
Not to walk on all fours. That is the law. And it was this thing that H.G. Wells wrote. So I had to do this at this big trial where Moreau is presiding, and I'm the guy with the staff.
Yeah.
And I decided to play him blind because I suddenly, you know, I think I was smoked some peyote, and I said, oh, Justice blind. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, that'd be cool.
Yeah. And they let you. Frankenheimer was okay with it.
Frankenheimer says, let me think about that, Rom. And so he thought about it for a day. He said, okay, I like it.
Yeah.
And I went to the makeup guys, and I said, I want to have those, you know, milky lenses.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, well, the only way to do that is the lenses are actually opaque. You cannot see through them. Yeah. They'll make you blind. And I said, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
It was biggest fucking stupid bonehead move. You know, I couldn't hit a mark. For the rest of it, I hated them putting the lenses in and taking them out. So once they put them in, I would just sit there for like 3 or 4 hours through lunch and everything, just so that they wouldn't fuck with my eyes.
Blind.
And I'm blind. I can't see. I have to be led everywhere.
And you're wearing horns.
And I'm trying to do a performance. I can't hit a mark. I have no idea who I'm.
You're working with your hero?
Brando is a foot and a half away from me.
You can't see him.
We're on this little platform. That, you know, that's big enough for his chair,
yeah,
and me.
Yeah.
And he's like, he's got a throne, and I'm there with a staff, and I'm giving these incantations. So we do the first shot. It takes us about 12 takes. We finally get this big shot. And then we're going to move in for Marlon's close-up. And so Marlon is talking to Frankenheimer. He says,
first thing I want you to do, John, I want you to take all these extras and put them in the shade. And give him a Coke. And he says, and I don't know who this guy is over here, but get rid of him.
He's talking about me. Now I've come 85,000 miles, you know,
yeah,
45 years to be in this guy's presence. And the first thing he says is, get rid of this guy.
I don't know who this guy is.
Get rid of this guy. So Frankenheimer says, well, we can't get rid of the extras, Marlon, because we need them for their reactions.
He says, it's a close-up on me, John. What do you fucking need? Put them in the shade. They're dying. There's no ozone. We're in Australia. Put them in the shade. Buy them a Coke. Take it out of my salary, John. Don't be a fucking Nazi.
And Frankenheimer says, Marlon, I protest. I'm not a Nazi.
He says, did you ever see a movie called The Young Lions?
He goes, oh, yes, Edward Dmytryk directed that, you and Montgomery Clift and Dean Martin. He says,
well, I know Nazis, John, and you're a fucking Nazi. Get rid of the extras and get rid of this fucking guy. I don't know what the fuck he's saying. I don't know what he's doing. He's very distracting.
And so I'm starting to, like, really get nauseous now. I'm about to throw up in my mask,
yeah.
You know, which reminds me of the movie The Verdict.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know, you throw up in your mask.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not a good thing. So he says, I'll make you a deal. I'll get rid of the extras, and but Perlman stays.
He goes, who's Perlman? He goes,
this guy's Perlman. He's playing the Sayer of the Law. And Marlon, for the first time, I guess, looks... I don't have my lenses in right now, so now I'm watching. I can see all this shit because we're getting ready. And he looks at me and he goes,
well, does he have to say those really dumb lines?
And Frankenheimer says, well, that's in the script. That's the script you agreed to do, Marlon. He's the Sayer of the Law. He says he has to say those lines. And I said... H. G. Wells wrote those, sir. And he goes,
I wasn't talking to you.
And so he says, look, the extras can go, have a Coke, Perlman stays.
He says, all right, but tell Perlman.
And now he's talking to me through Frankenheimer.
To just say it as quietly as he can, so maybe I can't even hear it, because it really sucks. It's bad.
And so the discussion goes on for so long that the first AD says, okay, we got to go to lunch, right?
Right.
I walk off the set, I go and I throw up. I go.
Just out of humiliation?
Yeah, I just go, all my life I've been fucking fantasizing about this guy. I would fuck this guy if I had the chance.
Yeah.
And he hates me.
Oh.
he thinks I'm a fucking idiot. He thinks I can't act. He thinks I talk too loud. I'm projectile vomiting through lunch.
Really?
And I have all these, and I'm really far from Phil Stutz, so I can't call him on the phone and say, Phil, what do you do when your hero has just destroyed you and you're about to go play a scene with him one-on-one?
Wow, what a unique situation.
And by the end of lunch, I said, you know, it would have been really nice if me and Marlon would have hit it off and we could talk about shit and, you know, Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront. And mm-hmm. I could tell him about my flights of daring do. But it just didn't happen. But here I am. They've paid me. They've hired me to do a job. I'm a professional actor. And I gotta do this performance. So fuck him. Fuck that fucking overweight, over the hill piece of shit. Fuck him. I'm going to destroy him in this scene.
That's where the anger works.
And that's what I channeled. And because I had to get my self-confidence back.
Yeah.
I had to. I mean, I was going to go out there with nothing. So we do the scene, but I could feel us doing the scene where I have a couple of lines, and then he speaks, and then I have a couple of lines.
But you got the contacts in.
And he speaks. I got the contacts in. And... we do it a few times, and by the last time we do it, I can feel him on my wavelength.
Yeah.
Like, we're now acting together.
Right.
And
that must have been acute sensitivity. You can't see, so you really gotta feel it.
But I can feel like, because I'm almost like the chorus in a Greek play.
Right.
And he has to come in and top it.
Yeah, right, right.
So there's a kind of it's like the chorus, and
so he's got to work off it. He can't fake it.
And he has now. I can feel him realizing that I have taken charge, and I'm conducting this fucking orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're either going to play or you're going to be fucking buried.
And the beautiful thing about this moment is, like, who gives a fuck about the movie?
Right, right,
right.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I mean, this is like,
to this day, nobody gives a fuck about the movie.
Exactly. But what I'm saying is that you've pulled your shit together, and you're working with the greatest it ever was, and finally you're locked in. I love the fact that you can't see. All you can do is feel like a real fucking actor, that you're locked in with the best actor that ever lived.
To make a long story short, I'll cut. So that was a big breakthrough, and that scene, which should have taken a day and a half to shoot, because the set was such a clusterfuck, and because Frankenheimer was so over his head, that scene took 5 days. And every time we got finished with a shot, I would sit there, because I didn't want to take my lenses out. I'd just sit there and wait, and Brando would go back to his trailer, and every time they got ready for him to come back, he would actually have to, like, move me, because I couldn't hear him, I couldn't feel him, and he would have to move me so he could get his overweight body into this chair. And for five...
I like that your respect is diminished enough that we can now, we can refer to him as the Fat Brando.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Yeah.
On day five, on day five, I'm sitting there and I'm waiting and it's a long relight. So I'm sitting there for about an hour. And I guess they say, okay, we're going to go with a picture and invite Mr. Brando. And I'm sitting there. And I suddenly feel two hands violently grab my shoulders.
Yeah.
And I go, and I turn around and I hear Brando go,
"Holy shit, what is that in your eyes?"
And I go, "What?"
He goes, Are you wearing lenses?
I go, "What are you asking me?" He goes,
"Wait a minute. Are you playing this guy blind?"
I go, "You're kidding, right?" I said, "We've been doing this fucking scene for 5 days, and it's the first time you realized I'm playing him blind?"
He goes, "Holy fuck. That's fucking brilliant. Oh, we need to start again." If I knew you were playing him blind, I would have done everything differently.
He thought you just were stinky acting.
He thought I was this big fucking loaf that wouldn't get out of his way when he wanted to get in his fucking chair. He had no idea. I couldn't see my hand in front of my face.
Oh my God.
And he also said,
and by the way, let me ask you something else. When I got here last week, there was like a whole basket of really great Latin, Cuban, African jazz. Was that from you?
And I went, "Yeah." And I was wondering whether you got it, because I never even heard like, "Hey, that's nice."
He goes, "Dude, I've been in my fucking trailer dancing my ass off to that stuff. How come you don't come in and hang out and dance with me?"
And I go, "Well, you know," and all of a sudden, you know, after 5 days, you know, he slaps me on the face, like, you know, which he loved to do.
Yeah, hey, yeah.
You're beautiful, kid. Thanks for the records, and come to the trailer.
Yeah. Which I never did, but it's a beautiful ending to what got off on a rocky footing.
You never went?
No, I never felt like I was his equal. I never felt like comfortable enough to just knock on his door and say, hey, Marlon, let's hang.
Did you do the scene again?
We finished the scene, and at the end of the scene, you know, you could tell he was like, "Nice job, kid," you know.
Did it play better once he figured out that you were blind?
No, nothing changed. The movie's horrible. I mean, the movie's just.
Wasn't there some weird debacle? Were you telling me that story that the original director never left the set?
Well, he never left Australia. He was after he got fired. He kind of stayed there.
But did he like linger around and become an extra or something?
He did. I'd prefer not. I'd love the guy so much, and I prefer not to talk about how deeply negatively that affected him. But it really hurt him.
Did he bounce back?
He's in the documentary, and it seems as though he's made his peace with it. I was invited to be in the documentary, and I chose not to, because I just. There's no reason to be in it unless you could tell everything that happened, and it would have hurt people to hear my
version.
Was
Val Kilmer in that too?
Yeah, that was one of the last moments of when, you know, of because at that point Val was, he's a huge deal.
He was like the new Brando, right?
Yeah.
What a great story, though.
Yeah.
Are you to this day? Do you regret not going to the trailer?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. I think it would be different now. I think I could like actually relax around him now. But back then I was, you know, I just couldn't do it. I just you're Marlon Brando and I'm, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's the fight you have.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, it's always been a little bit of that when I get around people who really take my breath away.
But it's funny though, don't you find, look, I've talked to a lot of guys. I mean, you know, you're a deep guy with an inner life. You're not vapid. You're a huge a fan of this stuff. You know, like you've been in this business long enough to know that you're fairly defined as a personality for an actor. You know what I mean?
I don't, but you know, I've met a lot of actors who are they have a shyness.
Yeah,
you know, they have a kind of there's something about them that where they're there's a place where they're not all that comfortable.
Right.
And I'm much more comfortable now than I've ever been.
Is it a sensitivity?
In my own skin. But it took a long time. It took a lot of work.
Yeah.
It took a lot of really uncomfortable moments like that where when he decided that, you know.
Get rid of that guy.
Yeah.
He's a fucking
clown.
Just
hurt you.
Oh, God. It was.
You threw up.
I threw up.
But it's a sensitivity, I guess. I mean, I guess it, like I never thought about it that way, because a lot of people say that, you know, actors a lot of times are a little, not necessarily empty, but they're able to fill up with other emotions and other characters because they're not that complicated. But I guess the other side of that is the sensitivity, that there has to be a vulnerability, that whether you want it there or not is there.
Mm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Whatever. What are you
now you're thinking?
I'm thinking like, oh shit.
I've
just shared my inmost darknesses. This is going everywhere.
But it's good. I'm happy you did it. And I'm happy you're working so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And I'm happy that we had this conversation.
Me too.
And I didn't mean to make anything sad.
No, I'm not sad. I'm not sad.
But like when I work with you, you know, when we had that time, like I felt the same way, like because I felt honored to work with a guy who, you know, who's a real actor, and like to see you work so effortlessly and seamlessly, and like I'm sitting there doing it with you, and I'm like, I it just felt like we're just talking and stuff,
yeah.
And then you look at the dailies, and I'm like, holy shit, this guy's like he lives on screen, you know, like you know, because yeah. Like when I'm in it, I'm like I just feel connected because I don't come from years of acting, so I'm like I'm just talking to a guy, and then you know I look at it, he's a fully formed character. It's all the craft just lands.
Right. Well, thank you. I mean, I've been, you know, I mean, not to sound like I'm quit pro crowing here, but it was a great experience watching you work on something that springs so personally out of you, and yet you're so comfortable with sharing with the world, because it reflects a huge ability to admit, hey, I don't have it all my shit together.
Yeah.
And but the way you performed it as on a purely acting level was wonderful.
Oh, thank you, man.
Wonderful.
That means a lot to me.
And no, it's a cool thing to watch.
So outside of the book and outside of where you know, working on the thing, is there something that, like, because I know we had talked once about you, just spending a lot of time with Freakin' on something never happened, but is there something that you really want to do for yourself?
So my conclusion to all of the you know, the stuff that I was ruminating about in trying to figure out why I even deserve to have a story to tell was, and part of it was my daughter going to SUNY Purchase, which is an acting conservatory school, and so she seemed like she was going to take the mantle. And in visiting her, I became Papa Ron, and all these kids who were in this arts program.
Yeah.
I'm taking them out for burgers, and I'm being invited to parties. They're like raves and shit.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I'm being invited into the inner circle, and I ended up getting very personally involved with a lot of these kids through their whole 4-year educational thing.
Oh yeah,
and the more deeply involved I became, the more I realized I should be able to say something to them when they get out of school that can maybe lighten their load, or you know, make the distance between point A and point B a little bit more direct,
uh-huh.
or something useful, something
yeah.
helpful,
right?
And this was one of the other reasons why I wanted to write the book, is because I've been answering a lot of questions from young actors,
uh-huh.
who like, well, how do you do this, and you know, what do you, and you know by going to school and learning how to play a scene, that doesn't mean I know how to fucking talk to an agent, or
right.
what happens when I get a call back, or what happens when I suddenly I'm making $100,000 an episode, you know, how do I manage that? I mean, it's tricky. There's a lot of tricky shit in the business that's not just about what you
acting.
Studied for
right.
the craft.
Yeah.
And this is how privileged you are to be in this fucking business. Because if you look on the shoulders of whom we're standing,
yeah, yeah,
you know, starting, you know, in the teens, in the 20s, in the 30s, everything that's mind-blowing that you can do on screen has already been done. Mm. It's already been done. Yeah. And it's been done by the fucking greatest people who ever walked the earth. And if you ever lose sight of that and you ever... So the book was also like a mind your manners kind of thing.
Yeah.
And never get... Never think that you're bigger than anything that's ever come because you're fucking tiny.
Yeah.
Compared to some of the people who have who have paved the way for us.
Yeah.
So it's partially that, but it's partially like I can't tell everybody the edifices that have been built or not built in replacement of the ones that no longer exist.
Yeah.
Are bankrupt. And one-dimensional and bullshit, and they're just nothing but, you know, the worshiping of false idols, which is money.
Uh-huh.
I can't be that guy unless I can, you know, like, what do you do about it?
Yeah,
you can't just complain. You have to figure out, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do.
Right.
And so the movie studio is my particular. Providing a place for myself and people who might be like-minded of me to ply our energies for reasons that aren't just driven by
money,
by bottom line, by...
So you started a studio?
Yeah. So I have a studio called Wing and a Prayer Pictures, and we've now produced three films. And,
which films?
One is called The Runaround. Which is looking for distribution right now. Another one is called Pottersville with the great Michael Shannon. Which is in post-production right now.
Oh,
another
great.
One is All I See Is You, which is directed by Mark Forster, which stars Blake Lively. And we have another four or five that are on the five-yard line getting ready to get greenlit.
Oh, you've come full circle and you're doing the beautiful
Louis B.
work.
I become Louis B. fucking Mayer.
Congratulations,
you're
Mr.
Welcome.
Mayer.
And you know, I'd like to continue working with you, Mr. Maron.
Dude, I'm ready. I'm ready for my close-up,
good.
Mr. Perlman.
I know you are. I know you are.
It's great talking to you.
Back at you, man.
That's it. That's the show. I thought it was beautifully human, and I love talking to him. Thank you, Ron. Again, thank you for listening, people. For my tour dates and my special More Later and WTF merch, you can go to WTFpod.com, powered by Squarespace. Tap into the abstract primal truth, or just listen to me play a little, let's do some more jazz lip trumpet. I feel like I've, not unlike my guitar playing, my jazz trumpet, my hotel room trumpet, kind of seems to fall back on similar riffs. Let me try. Let's pick it up. Let's pick up the swing. I'm having a hard time with my mouthpiece. Boomer lives.